How Spies Think, from the former director of GCHQ. You can learn the mythology used by British intelligence agencies to reach judgments, establish the right level of confidence, and act decisively. It's the new book by David Armand, How Spies Think, 10 Lessons in Intelligence. And some of us, I think, need that on a Monday morning. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, David Armand himself. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. How spies think. Why do spies then think differently to the rest of us on a Monday morning, please?
Well, they think very rationally. When we have decisions to take, we have two kinds of thinking to hold in our minds. There's the rational analysis of whatever faces us, and then there's the emotional side, what we want to get out of a decision, or perhaps what we fear and want to avoid by a decision. And we have to bring the two kinds of thinking together in our heads. In the UK, we can see this at the moment with COVID-19, where we have the scientific committee, SAGE, doing rational analysis, and we have the politicians using their democratic mandate, making decisions, you know, in the light of their objectives. And the two have to be brought together. And intelligence analysts, you know, have spent many years working out what is the best way of conducting that kind of rational analysis. They're very good at it.
I mean, you could argue that, you know, to go back to layman's term, the heart ruling over the head, we have an emotional reaction to several things. Perhaps we are creatures driven by impulse, and that can override a rational response.
That's always been true. And, of course, politics is a contact sport. The public always aims off a bit for political swagger and exaggeration, and also the personal ambitions and rivalries that are inseparable from democratic politics. But we shouldn't have to suffer those who blur or even deny the very nature of a fact. And that's what really drove me to write the book, was watching and seeing what was happening on social media and the half-truths and the distortions that get pushed around on the internet. And that's very far from the kind of rational analysis of big issues that we all face.
But in a world where we have been reduced to a tweet, to a 10-second soundbite, forget 50, famous for 15 minutes, it's famous for 15 seconds, we have clickbait, we have things where people will look at a picture, see a caption, go, right, that's my belief. I kind of thought that anyway in the first place, and stick to that. So how difficult is it to convince people to step back from their gut reaction and go further? And how indeed can they find those facts?
We really do have to persuade people that we're now living in a world where respecting the truth no longer seems to be as important as creating an emotional impact. It's been called the spread of truth decay. I would like it to be true becomes, if social media keeps repeating it, it might be true, and then that slides too easily into, well, it's as good as true. And that's how we get these ridiculous conspiracy stories about COVID-19 circulating, for example. And these are really dangerous to public health. So I think we've all got to start saying to each other, don't believe it just because you read it in a tweet or see it on a page on social media. Think a little more clearly about who is trying to convince me of what. And can I do a cross-check to see whether the information I'm being given is actually valid? I think we should start in schools. I think we should start teaching critical thinking to our children so that they grow up living confidently and safely online. Because there is quite a lot of bad stuff around. And I say the COVID-19 anti-vaxxer propaganda could be really dangerous.
The thing is, I'm of a generation, pre-internet generation. You know, I went to school in the 70s and the 80s, pre-internet. And so if I wanted to research a project, I remember my parents had a massive amount of Encyclopedia Britannica that took up one half of the bookshelf. And, you know, I would go away and I would read from the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I would go to the library and borrow books for a project I was doing, whatever it was, historical, whatever. Today, of course, we are told that the internet is the future. Every child must have an iPad. And, of course, At that point, you open in an entire Pandora's box of, yes, there are some brilliantly researched essays and research there, but at the same time, there are people who are, you know, pandering to perhaps the more extreme, on both sides, theories and depositions, and they will find the Illuminati behind the Rothschilds, behind the, in everything that we do.
Yeah, that's right. I'm even older than you are. And I remember a world in which you didn't have immediate access to all that information. You had to work a bit harder and get to a library or read a book. Now, the internet is a great thing. Don't get me wrong. Our economic and social future is dependent on it. How on earth would we be managing the current COVID crisis if we couldn't communicate online with each other and keep in touch with family? But the downside is that the business model of the internet encourages emotional content. The more clicks you get, the cheaper it is to advertise. It's built into the system. And of course, that is what is now being used to attract our attention for other purposes, for political purposes, and indeed, as we've seen, sadly, also for propaganda. So the only answer is that we've all got to get rather more cautious in before we start to retweet or to believe what we're reading. And there's a big role here for journalists. I think the sunlight is the best disinfectant. The more you expose some of the nonsenses which go on, such as trying to associate 5G with COVID, the more that gets exposed in journalism, the more people will realize, well, hang on, that story is somebody has invented it for malicious purposes. It's not true.
The problem with that, of course, is the fact that with many editors and newspapers under fire and needing to make a buck, you know, and I've seen this before, you know, with my own eyes, the journalists or editors will push for something, the image, the headline, get it out before the competitors get it out, was always the way of newspapers. But now in a social media world, we're talking, you know, many of my friends are photographers, and they're basically out of business, the paparazzi or the photographers on a story, because everybody's got a camera in their phone. It immediately goes on the social media. Your editor is screaming at you saying, you know, get me the picture, what's happening on the ground. And rather than having that time period of reflection that we used to have, it has to be immediate.
Yeah, and we're going to have to learn to live with that, because that is the nature of the way the internet is built. That's the business model that pays for the free point-of-use service. When you click a search, up comes the answer. So we've got to get our minds around that's the world we're in, and then learn to live more safely. And I think we can do that. I think the internet companies are beginning to realize that it's not a good look to have your major advertisers on a page alongside disgraceful content, for example, child abuse images. So they've started to filter the material that's passing through their pipes. We have good laws in this country against certain kinds of hate speech. So if it's an offence to stand up and say it or to write it in a newspaper, it's an offence to say it online. And in that way, I think we can gradually change our attitudes to just simply being emotionally moved. Mm. The intelligence community is very good at cold calculating analysis, and the one thing they know, rule number one, you mentioned my book as a subtitle, 10 Lessons in Intelligence, rule number one is that our knowledge of the world is always imperfect, it's fragmentary, and it's sometimes wrong. So don't leap, just pause and look and see how far down is it before you make that jump.
It would have been very easy to just have sort of ten of easy. I mean, writing a book like this is never easy. But as well as giving the 10 lessons in intelligence, you've given examples because you were the former director of GCHQ.
Yeah.
Thank you. So you've drawn on some, if you like, some experiences, including briefing prime ministers. I mean, briefing Margaret Thatcher must have been, you must have wanted to get your facts absolutely straight before you walked into a briefing with the Iron Lady.
Well, that's right. And she was easy to brief because if you had the facts straight and you'd thought through your opinions and the advice you were giving, she'd push back, of course, and test. But if she was satisfied, you knew what you were doing, then she would accept the advice. The most dramatic instance, which I put in the book, was at the time of the Falklands campaign, when I was working for John Knott, who was the Defence Secretary. And John and I were in his room in the House of Commons working on a speech when a runner arrived from Whitehall with a locked pouch, and in the pouch were three GCHQ intercepts of Argentine naval communications that they had picked up and deciphered. And the meaning of those intercepts was very clear to me. I worked there. It was that by the end of the week, the Argentine junta would have occupied the Falkland Islands and invaded. So we looked at each other, and then we rushed down the corridor and burst in on the Prime Minister and said, "Prime Minister, you've got to look at this." And she looked up and said, "This is very serious, isn't it?" To which there's only one response: "Yes, Prime Minister." And that's how she learned that the Argentine junta was about to occupy the Falkland Islands. In that case, I think those GCHQ intercepts and their brilliant work in deciphering those communications saved her and her government, because if she'd woken up on the Saturday morning to discover a fait accompli, you know, they were there, they were on the island, and it was suddenly out in the open. As it was, she had a few days in which she decided that we would put together a task force and send it to the South Atlantic so she could announce that on the Saturday.
Mm.
And that helped reduce the sense of shame that there was nothing that could be done to actually physically stop them because the islands are so far away.
I was speaking with an author who's written a book on GCHQ recently, and they said that in the Falklands conflict itself, the work that particular establishment did was worth basically 20% of the task force because of the information coming in about Argentine battle cruisers with exocets looking to sink one of the carriers, which would have had a disastrous effect on the campaign, and work like that whilst you were at GCHQ must have been one of the main things you draw up surely when you come to lessons in intelligence.
Yes, it is, and it's the same role that was performed by the famous Bletchley Park during the Second World War and the Battle of the Atlantic. It requires a very unusual kind of person, unusual kind of mind, by very diverse set of minds to come together and to work on those sorts of very hard problems, because finding the communications in the first place, then capturing them, then deciphering them is a major intellectual task. But it does mean, of course, that the nation, I think, is very well served. Now, I come back to my first lesson. You can't always guarantee it will be available. The intelligence will be available when you need it. And you certainly can't always accept that it will always be right, because mistakes do get made. And there is deception. And that's something I cover in the book. There's a whole chapter on deception, because there are people out there who are today trying to deceive us, and the Russian interference with the 2016 US presidential election and the current election, the interference which is believed they tried to conduct on our 2019 general election. We don't know enough to know whether there was interference during the Brexit referendum, or indeed going further back, the Scottish referendum. But those are now very well researched, how, particularly using social media and by hacking in and stealing emails and releasing them, our hostile intelligence service can try and deceive us.
Away from trying to work your way through and shine a light through the smoke and mirrors that are, that is the modern social media industry, you also look at things like the information you need to making the next career move. Presumably that, that's as getting as much information and running through as many different scenarios and thinking of the possibilities in advance.
Yes, the I have an acronym, SEES, S-E-E-S, and the first four chapters of the book is one for each of those letters. So the first is situational awareness, the facts. Do you really know enough to make the decision, the facts? But the second E is explanation, because facts by themselves are dumb. I use the example in the book. Suppose there's a fact in front of a court that the accused's fingerprints were on the fragments of a bottle that was thrown at the police. Does that mean he threw the bottle? Or did the mob rushing past his house pick a bottle out of his recycling bin? Two explanations of the same fact. One would lead to guilty, the other would lead to innocent. So when you have even what seem to be very solid facts still have to be explained. And this is certainly true when it comes to motivations. You may have been given the job offer. What's behind it? You have to explain what's going on. And then the third E is estimation. How will events pan out if you either take a decision, or if you decide you're not going to take a decision, how are things going to pan out? And then the final fourth output from intelligence work is what I call strategic notice. And that's whilst you're focused on that immediate decision, is something else going to come and hit you on the back of the head? So have you got strategic notice of other things that might happen, or that might really disturb the basis of your decision? So those four things, you know, first get the facts right as best you can, you know, the strategic notice. Then just make sure you've explained why you're seeing what you're seeing. Then try and estimate how things are going to pan out and events may unfold. And then just keep that little bit at the back of the mind thinking, what else is there out there that might come and hit me? Or opportunity that might come along that I might seize? We're all focused on COVID at the moment, but there are other nasty things out there. And I hope somebody in government is just keeping a wary eye open in case there's something else coming along, or indeed in case the virus mutates and develops different characteristics.
And how much of this, because we are forever getting sort of bombarded by books that tell us this and tell us that, and how to live happy lives and how to, I don't know, do five yoga salutations before the sun comes up. How much of this is will become muscle memory, if you like, or intelligence memory, the more you practice it?
Oh, I think the two kinds of thought, the dispassionate rational analysis and the emotion, understanding your emotions. Those, if the more you practice trying to distinguish these, trying to work out, you know, what actually do you want to get out of this decision, but then just checking rationally whether the you've got the story straight, keeping those two in balance. The problem at the moment, particularly driven by social media, is that the purely emotional response is tending to bleed into the rational and is tending to distort the rational analysis. What then happens is what you might call magical thinking. There's something I want, I'm going to take the decision, I'm going to announce the decision if I'm a politician, but I haven't rationally worked out how on the ground is it actually going to happen. Are the resources there to make it happen? And too often, I think, at the moment, we get big, bold announcements from politicians, but they haven't actually done all the rational analysis of how on earth is that going to be delivered. It's like building a wall from the top row of bricks downwards. You hold up the top row of bricks with a bit of faith and some hot air, and then you wait for somebody else to fill in underneath, and it doesn't always work.
It's that big announcement, is it? That big announcement and world-beating and moonshotting, and then actually we haven't actually put any scaffolding in at all. How much enjoyment, if that's the right word, or how much satisfaction did you get about putting together this book and revisiting some of the moments where, you know, thinking like a spy was proved to be the correct way?
Yeah, well, I started it. Really thinking about the book after the Brexit referendum and the 2016 US presidential election, and I wanted to send out this call to arms in favour of being more careful about rational analysis to support decision making. And then I began to realise, of course, that in my own career there were episodes that would help to illustrate the case I wanted to make and my model, my CEES model for the outputs of intelligence, what you really ought to think about when you go about trying to make a decision. And it's why the applicability. I put a chapter in the book about negotiation. How do you, if you're buying a used car, how do you go about the negotiation? What do you need to know? And what do you need to infer about the motivations of the person who's trying to sell the car, who may have rather different objectives, or will have different objectives from your objectives in wanting to buy it? And there's also this the question, I say, of obsessions and conspiracies. It's very noticeable just how many conspiracy stories are around at the moment on social media, and how do we go about trying to prevent people falling into that conspiratorial mindset, particularly when events around us are so confusing. It's quite tempting to think, well, there's some mastermind somewhere, some malign James Bond villain somewhere that's cooked all this up. And that's the beginnings of, falling into a conspiracy. And once you're in a conspiracy and you start to think that way, when people come along with contrary evidence, you tend to dismiss them. You tend to say, no, I can explain everything that's going on by the conspiracy itself, which leads to some very dangerous thinking.
Indeed. What do you hope, then, that people will take from your book? Like I said, it might be regarded as a big ask to say to people, look, have you thought thinking rationally? I mean that without insulting them, obviously.
No, indeed, and we all have native intelligence, and some people use it extremely well. It doesn't require, many university degrees and so on to think rationally. Most people do it most of the time. But what worries me is the gradual effect that all this exposure to social media and to information on the internet that is deliberately presented in an emotional way, in an eye-catching way, over time, that will have an effect on the way we think. And we need to be conscious of that. So, the book is not going to revolutionize the way everyone thinks. But if it just makes people pause a little bit and think, particularly those with children or grandchildren, and just think, could we actually explain rather better than we are doing at the moment some of the risks there are, as well as the benefits of the internet?
I've done a couple of lectures, and when I speak to people, I say, because having worked in journalism, I say, we have to become our own editors. Perhaps with this book, we also have to become our own intelligence agencies.
Yes, I do say very firmly in the book, this is not an invitation to behave badly and spy on other people. And most of the information we need for everyday decisions is available. You don't need to steal it. So this is not about becoming a spy. This is about the analyst. This is about how you go about making sense of the world and taking solid, evidence-based decisions that will help you actually achieve your goals.
The book is called How Spies Think, 10 Lessons in Intelligence. It's by Sir David Omand. Sir David, if people want to find you, I was going to say, can they find you on social media? But how can we be sure it's you?
Well, indeed. I'm not on social media, so save the time on that. But I can always be contacted at King's College, where I'm a visiting professor.
And the book is available as a virtual download from our virtual bookstop. The book is called How Spies Think. It's by Sir David Omand. Sir David, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.